guys had a nice weekend. We have an exam coming up Thursday, just a reminder. And I don't think I've mentioned that you do want to bring your calculator. Won't be overly calculational probably, but there'll be some things where you might want to use your calculator. Again, one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, anything you want written on it. Nice support to coin, whatever works for you. Q&A session. I thank those of you who filled out the Doodle poll. I have somebody trying to arrange a room now, sort of based on preferences. But of course, predictably, the preferences are pretty even, which means no matter when I choose a time, it's not going to be ideal for everybody. But it is what it is. You're welcome to email questions, some of which, to sort of think about it, some of them are easier to answer via email than others. If it's not so practical to answer via email, I mean, feel free to set up a time or drop by if you have questions that you want to. But the Q&A session will be the sort of, by my schedule and workshop schedules, is sort of constraining to Wednesday afternoon, so it will be some time in there. Any questions, issues on the exam? No? Yes?
How do you suggest studying?
How do I suggest studying?
I know it differs from person to person.
Yeah, well, it does. I probably don't have a whole lot to tell this class, right? Most of you are sophomores. You've survived 121 and 122 at least.
I didn't do that.
You didn't do that? Oh, okay. It's not a memorization course. So, doing the problems, the workshop problems, looking at looking over the problems that sound workshop with the caveat that you know that there are some holes there, right? You're not going to find the Lorentz transformations in any of those problems and stuff like that. So, just be systematic. You can look through all the various topics through time. You know, I do not have a better place to send you to learn anything about four vectors than the chapter from Griffiths that I posted on the web. I think he writes very well. I think he lays it out there. So I think that's the place to actually learn about it. So, it's physics. So the thing is, when you do problems, that's when you realize that, oh, you really didn't understand something. I mean, I don't have big worries about this class, but I do have sort of a funny story about it. If you read a chapter, or if I happen to be on one day and you come out of it feeling warm and fuzzy about stuff because I gave an okay lecture, that doesn't actually mean you understand very much, necessarily. So I have it as a physics 113 student, got knocked around on one of the exams and came in wondering what was going on. And so it turns into this Q&A session where I try to figure out how to study so I can give them some advice. And this particular student sort of stands out because they said, well, I study, I read each chapter 7 times. Okay, that's impressive. And then I said, basically, well, tell me how you do the problem sets. And the answer was, well, I figure by the time I've read each chapter 7 times, I understand this stuff, so I don't bother with the problem set. And the nice thing about that was that it was a very easy thing to fix with that particular student. So anyway, I think when I tell a lecturer or if the author is good, they're sort of telling a story, and hopefully it does make sense. But it's somehow in the problems that you sort of confront the things you actually really understand or don't understand. So that would be my biggest surprise. Any other questions? Okay, so we've been talking about Fourier analysis. And remember that in Fourier analysis, we basically can describe any periodic function in terms of an infinite series of harmonic functions in that wavelength or sub-multiples of that wavelength, integral sub-multiples. And last time, I didn't derive for you, but I hope I motivated for you that as the wavelength in this periodic function becomes large, you pull in higher frequencies and the density of the frequencies. You pull in higher frequencies, basically. And these sums can become continuous. And the expression, the A sub k's, the B sub k's, which in the series form, which we've studied, are the coefficients that basically multiply each of these integral submultiples, become smooth functions, which are given by these integrals. Okay, so they depend on the function, and you can evaluate these. And so what happens is we have this smooth function in position space or time space, and we can actually find a different basis in which we can describe it, which is in K space, which remember is spatial frequency, or omega space, which is temporal frequency. So we have spatial and time representations, or equivalently, we can talk about frequency representations. All right, and these are called the Fourier integrals. And so this is the cosine transform, and the other one is the sine transform. I really don't know what's up with the shock sensor utility. Sorry, it just seems to want to stay on. At any rate, so one of the reasons that I wanted to show this to you was really the fact that you sort of have these two representations. And what we find is that if you describe, for example, narrower functions in space or sharper details in space or time, then the frequency representations basically become broader, and you have to include more and more frequencies to make that up. And that, I hope, makes sense. In terms of spatial piece, if I go to a very, very narrow pulse, I'm going to need to have a very high frequency wave in order to pull it in and have it contribute to that pulse shape, if you want to think about adding and superimposing the different waves in order to create the shape. And in this class, one of the main reasons I sort of wanted to show this to you is because in time we'll be doing quantum mechanics, and one of the things that makes quantum mechanics absolutely fabulously strange is the uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle really will follow from basically this and the fact that you, in doing quantum mechanics, are treating the particles as waves. It is much more powerful than that classically, so if you're in optics or other stuff, you're going to see Fourier analysis and frequency representations of spatial and temporal things again and again and again. Sometimes it's a really fabulous way to do analysis. Were any of you at John Powell's colloquium last Wednesday? Okay, one of the things they're working on is compression, data compression. I mean, if you're taking video or photographs, and you have to send them, I mean, just imagine what a predator drone has to do, right? They have to take high resolution photographs, but then that data has to be sent somewhere. So there are lots of bits that have to be digitized, you know, have to send in principle. So one of the things John showed, which I thought was really fabulous, was and working with the project, one of the projects they're on, he showed a picture of his son with some, you know, normal background back there. And, you know, he said, how many pixels it is, some big megapixel camera or whatever, and you look at it. And obviously, if you're going to send that picture in that representation, then that's how many pixels you have to send. It's a lot of data. But if you look at the picture that he had, it was sort of dark in the background, sort of white where the face was, sort of dark over here. Well, that is low, high, low. You can think of that as a long wavelength change in intensity of the light, or the color of the light, right? And if you look at the picture, what you find is there are relatively few frequency components when you take that picture and transform it into frequency space. So that you can describe this picture in frequency space and literally send that information, and it's way fewer bits by some really large factor. Right. And so this is a form of data compression. So there are lots of practical applications to this, and you'll run into it again and again, sort of, if you stay in this business. So that's why I dragged you through that. And I'm about to change... subjects here, rather drastically, I guess. We'll still talk about ladies, but any questions, thoughts about Fourier stuff before I move on? Alright, so the theme is waves, and by far and away, one of the most important types of waves that's out there are electromagnetic waves, and I would argue that the stuff that we're going to do today is possibly one of the... I would argue it's the most important single accomplishment of any human being that's out there. I mean, this is an amazing synthesis. Okay. So what I want to do is to take the stuff that we have learned about in electromagnetism and derive light from it. So how many of you have actually seen a derivation of electromagnetic quantum wave? Some of you. What class is that? 142. Okay, so that's good. Okay. So it is appropriately done in 142. It's appropriately done in higher level classes. If you had 122, I don't know. Anybody had 122? Did Regina do that? She really derived it, or did she just show it to you? Didn't
know. Can't
Okay. You need to probably remember. Alright, so I'm gonna very quickly review sort of the essence of electromagnetism a la Maxwell's equations. And then I'm going to, at pretty good pace, derive electromagnetic plane waves. I'm gonna do that, one, because I really want to make sure you've seen it. Two, there's some techniques that I also want you to have seen. But one of the things, the message I'm making here, is this is not an electromagnetism course. So in terms of what I expect you to do, it's not to do this kind of derivation on your test or anything. I want you to be very comfortable with what we end up with. But that is, I want you to develop an intuition about electromagnetic plane waves and what comes out of all this, okay? But I think you need to have seen this stuff. So if you haven't seen it before, it's probably going to be a little fast. If you have seen it before, maybe it'll stick. I don't know. But just slow me down when I go through something that you that doesn't make any sense. All right, so I hope... And by the way, if any of you ignored my emails about why you should have taken E&M before you come to this class, today's the day. All right, because we're starting at Maxwell's equations. I want to remind you what you got out of Maxwell's equations and where they came from. All right, this is Gauss's law. So what it says is that I can have any volume, and I can integrate the electric flux coming out of it, or into it, the net electric flux going through that surface, remember this is the integral of E dot dA, so you're projecting the electric field that's penetrating the surface at right angles to that surface, right? And you're summing all of that up. Some may be coming in, some may be coming out. And in the end, when you do that sum, you end up basically with a measure of the net electric charge inside the thing. And it's not an obvious thing. And just to remind you, the reason you had to learn about it is that under certain circumstances of symmetry, E is either parallel or perpendicular to dA, so that this dot product is easy to do. And if you choose the symmetry right, so you have a spherically symmetric charge distribution, for example, you can choose a Gaussian surface that's spherically symmetric, then you know that the electric field is constant along the surface. So you do the dot product, and then E is constant, you can pull it out. So the left-hand side is easy to do, and if you can sum up the charge, which again, for a symmetric thing, usually it can do, but if it preserves the symmetry, this becomes a really useful way for determining the electric field. But more than that, it's a very fundamental characteristic of electromagnetism that basically is a statement that there exists point sources for the electric charge, whatever the hell electric charge is. Okay? It doesn't really tell you that so much, but it's whatever the charge is. If you do the same thing for magnetism, and this you don't usually get have to look at in your even course too often until you get the Maxwell's equations. This is basically a statement that there exists no point charges for magnetism. There are no magnetic monopoles. So you do this same sum and you don't have a Q magnetic. So it's always zero. And that's the way it is in the universe as we seem to have it. Now it turns out that fundamentally in the particle physics level, there's no reason this would be true. In fact, quite the opposite. Theoretically, people believe there should be magnetic monopoles in principle. And in cosmology, it's a big problem that we don't actually see them. And it turns out that this is one of the compelling theoretical reasons that people believe prior to the Big Bang, there was a period of very, very dramatically, that's really an understatement. There's amazing expansion of space-time that they call inflation that happened before the space characteristics settled down and created what we would think of as our Big Bang. So it's a really wacky idea. It's called inflation, and if you start reading about cosmology, you learn about it. One of the theoretical problems that it fixes is the fact that in the very early universe, there should have been magnetic monopoles, and yet if we go out, we don't see them. They're not out there. And so a way to have that is to have the very early universe be small, have magnetic monopoles, and then blow it up so big that if you take any piece of it, you'll basically have no magnetic monopoles in it, because the monopole's density is the same. But anyway, that said, one of the things you can see is that the fact that we have no magnetic monopoles sort of leads to an asymmetry in these equations, which is, silly as it may sound, one of the reasons that we believe magnetic monopoles probably have to exist, because in general, as strange as it may seem, it does seem that nature very often is described well by beautiful math. And this would be more beautiful if we had magnetic monopoles on. So yeah, tell that to some of your art friends. I mean, you guys know enough now to look at this and could appreciate that symmetry, right? I mean, you will develop a feeling, if you haven't already, of sort of what pretty math is. Anyway, so that's what this says. Ampere's law is that if I integrate around a closed loop, B dot dl, so dl is each bit going around the loop, and I integrate taking the dot product of the magnetic field around all those points, it's equal to mu zero I. This is the integral of the current density through surface. This is just the current. The current that goes through that loop. So generally you do most of your calculations in 142 or 122 with just this form, integral B dot dl is mu zero I. And what you do with those things is you have some coaxial cable, it has a certain current, you put the Amperian loop around it, you calculate the current that penetrates that Amperian loop, because the B field circulates around the I, you have, again, conditions of symmetry that allow you to calculate the left-hand side, and it's a way to calculate. And so it's sort of, in some sense, the magnetic equivalent of what you're doing in these classes to Gauss's law. There's this other weird term that's often not discussed until you see Maxwell's equations, and it basically takes care of the case where you have something like a capacitor in the circuit where you can draw the surface that is bounded by that Amperian loop in such a way that it doesn't actually get cut by the current. And in order to fix that problem, you have to add in something that instead of thinking of it as a current, you think of it as a changing electric flux through that surface. And so this is known as Maxwell's displacement current. And you need this in order to close that loophole. And so that's the final form of effectively Ampere's law. And then Faraday's law is induction. Right? If I have a changing magnetic flux, it will induce an electric field sort of at right angles to it, or it will give you a voltage and induce EMF going around the loop. Okay? You guys happy with that? I hope you've seen it before. Okay. So what I'd like to do, because it is much better, okay, the integral form is generally what most of us learn. What I'm about to derive is the differential form of Maxwell's equations, because that is the easiest place to jump from to look at plane waves. So you need to get pretty familiar with vector operators if you aren't already. So here is the vector operator del. We've seen it before. It's basically the three spatial derivatives along with the unit vectors. You can certainly, this is the Cartesian version of it. It looks quite different if you do it in spherical polar coordinates or cylindrical coordinates. And when you take higher level EM classes, that's one of the things that will make life very painful for you. If I do the dot product of this vector operator with a vector, you take this and you do the same thing you would if it were two vectors, basically, except now this operates on that piece. And remember, for dot product, you can make use of the orthogonality of these unit vectors. And so when you do that, you get this. Remember that the dot product gives you a scalar. So this is a scalar. And it basically takes the x component, and the x component multiplies them together and adds them to the y component, plus the y component. But now, instead of simple multiplication, you're operating with this vector operator. Okay, so this thing is called the divergence. And what it actually is a measure of is the degree to which the vector field is diverging from a point at that particular point. So you have a divergence at every point in the field. And that divergence may be zero. So for example, if the vector field is just a parallel, then you'll have no divergence here because it's not increasing or getting smaller. If you think of the vector field as being a point source, of the field, or a sink of it, you'll have a lot of divergence. Okay? So that is what we call the divergence. Sometimes you'll see it as little div times the vector. And in order to get to the differential form of Maxwell's equations, we make use of the divergence theorem. And I think it goes by other names, and I'm not proving it to you, but basically it says that the integral of the surface area of a vector dotted into the area vector on the surface is equal to the volume integral of the divergence of that vector field. And so if I take Gauss's law, note that this piece is that piece in terms of form, so I can rewrite this surface integral over the electric field in terms of the divergence of the electric field. And because this is now a volume integral, I'm going to rewrite Q enclosed as a volume integral. So that's just rho dV. And now I have integrals over the same volume. I basically can just get rid of the integral form. I have that the divergence of the electric field is rho over rho being the charge density. It is not zero, and this is again the statement that you have point charges for electric field because you have electric field that goes out or into electric charges. Okay? And based on what we were just saying, you might imagine that the divergence of magnetic field will have to be zero because there is no magnetic charge density. Alright? And in fact, because this is zero, boom, there's here. So these are the differential forms of the first two equations we had written up. Okay? Okay, another vector operation that we want to use a lot is called the curl, given by this cross product. So basically the cross product of the del operator, right? Remember that's this basic operator. Have you seen it done this way? Did you evaluate cross product? Okay. So del cross V, you can put the IJK, put the components of del, put the components of V, and then you do the cross product, and you get, if you don't know how to do that, be sure to ask me so I can show you how. But basically, you get these six terms, and the curl is a measure of the degree, or the curl at point P is a measure of the circulation of the vector field around that point. Okay, so for example, if it's a point charge and you're looking at the electric field going out radially, there's no circulation because it just goes out radially. So the curl of that would be zero, for example. Again, parallel vector lines would have no curl. This would have very large curl. This would have no curl. So the intuition that you should have about curl is at every point it measures how much the vector field will circulate about that point. Where we use it is in converting the other two Maxwell's equations into differential form. Using Stokes' theorem, which allows you to rewrite the line integral, the line integral of V dot DL in terms of a curl of V. So you take this line integral and you turn it into a surface integral across the surface that is subtended by that curve. So if we take the integral of V dot DL, for example, we can rewrite that as the integral over the surface area of the curl of V, dotted in dA as per Stokes' theorem. Faraday's law lets neglect the... No, this is Faraday's law of induction. So remember that this degree of the induced EMF is equal to the changing magnetic flux at a certain time. Well, we write magnetic flux as an area integral so that we have an area integral here and an area integral here, and del cross C is going to be equal to minus dB over dT. That's the differential form of that equation. Okay? And then if we take Ampere's law plus Maxwell's displacement current and do the same trick, we can convert this into the surface integral, the area, the surface integral of del cross V, and we take the other side. We already have this in terms of a surface integral, and we rewrite the electric flux in terms of a surface integral, and we can take out the three surface integrals that we have, and we end up with this form for the differential equation. Okay. All right, so here's the summary of where we are. We've taken the stuff that you should be very familiar with and changed it into the differential form of Maxwell's equations. And now I want to look at those very carefully. What I'd like to do is to consider a region of space where there is no charge density and there's no current, which will mean that this one, which has a row up here, is zero, and the J terms here will go to zero. Okay, so we have a region of no space. I mean, no current. So this is Faraday's law or Ampere's law, which is one of us. And what I'd like to do with this is then take the curl of each side. I'm just going to act on it with that vector operator. And You know, and then God said, this is true. And I'm not proving that to you. But this is a vector operator identity. And if somebody really hates you, they'll make you prove that in 237 or whatever that course is. So the divergence of B is zero. So this term goes to zero. And that leaves you with this term where you have the divergence of the gradient of the field. Remember that the gradient of the field is a vector, but if you take the divergence of that vector, then we have what's known as the Laplacian. And it gets a new symbol, which we use as del squared. Okay? And it's a little tricky because you can actually take the Laplacian of both vector and scalar fields. So if we have a scalar field, remember you take gradients of scalar fields. So the gradient can only operate on a scalar field. Right? So therefore the Laplacian can only be taken on the scalar field. So if you define that, then we're taking the divergence of the gradient of t. The gradient, remember, is just this operating on the scalar field. It's just it's the derivative with respect to x in the I direction, derivative with respect to y in the j direction, derivative with respect to z in the z direction. And that's what the gradient is. Now, if I dot that into the del vector, then you end up with the second derivatives here. So the Laplacian of t is just the second derivatives of t with respect to the various components in the system. And this is now a scalar. Okay. Now, what we were looking at a moment ago is the curl of the curl of B, which we see is this thing, and we called it the Laplacian of B, and B is a vector. So that's not, strictly speaking, correct, because we just said the Laplacian is the divergence of a gradient, and you can only take the gradient of a scalar field. So how do you do it for a vector? And the way we define the Laplacian of a vector field is basically taking the well-defined Laplacian of the scalar components in turn. So this would be the Laplacian of the x component of B. This is the Laplacian of the y component of B. And this is the Laplacian of the z component of B. Each of those components is just a scalar, because it only becomes part of the vector when you have them combined with their direction. Okay? All right, so with that in hand, what I want to do is take the curl of B on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, I take the curl of the right-hand side. I started out with the Maxwell equations that del cross B is mu 0 times epsilon 0 times the derivative of the electric field with respect to time, and I take the curl of each side. I get this quantity that we were just discussing. On the right-hand side, the curl comes in, and I take the curl of E inside the time derivative. This, we just discussed, becomes the vector, the Laplacian of the vector field. The right-hand side is, again, curl of E here. And remember that we have another Maxwell's equation that tells us that the curl of E is the change of B with respect to time. So when we pull all that together, what we get is the Laplacian of the vector field on the left-hand side and the second derivative with respect to time of B on the right-hand side. I now remember that this basically gives you the Laplacian of each component separately. So I take the Laplacian of the x component here and set it equal to the x component here because it's a vector equation. I do the same for y and z. So here is the scalar Laplacian of the x component of b, and it's equal to minus mu e times the second derivative of time with respect to bx. And I have similar things for y and z. Okay? If we look at that, this really is just second derivatives with respect to space. The other side, we have second derivatives with respect to time. That's a wave equation you look at. Right? Instead of a single-dimensional wave equation, it's now a three-dimensional wave equation because you sort of have these three pieces, and they look a little bit strange because what you're doing is you're allowing the x component of b to actually change. It could be a function of x, y, and z. So this is a wave equation for b sub x. Okay? So that's the page we just saw. So if I look at it this way, I have one of these in y and one of these in z. So basically, you know, this is a three-dimensional wave equation for b. And I can do the analogous derivation starting with the del cross theorem. Remember, we started taking the curl of the curl of B. If you go back and you take the curl of the curl of E from the Maxwell's equation, it has the del cross E on the other side. And you go through the same kind of stuff that we just went through, you get the analogous equation without the shock sensor utility on it. Remember, you know, this is the one-dimensional wave equation that we derived in class. These are the three-dimensional analogs. This constant that multiplies these gives you 1 over the speed of the wave. And I think that it had to be one of the most magical moments that any human has ever experienced when Maxwell popped out this equation and then took these constants and calculated the speed of that wave and came up with something, the speed of light. Right? It's got to be absolutely cool. Any comments, questions? Remember, what makes a wave instead of just simple harmonic motion is the fact that you have a connection. Right? If we have a rope and I yank on the rope here, it pulls a piece up here, it pulls a piece up here. So there's a connection from each element. So what we've seen are mechanical waves where that connection is literally mechanical. You have a wire that holds these bars, and I move the bars so the wire, the torsion in the wire causes the other bars to turn. In a stadium, it's the mental time, right? Everybody jumps up in the right time. For pressure waves, it's literally the pressure of the particles moving next to them, the water waves. So you have all of that. So here we have wave equations, but what's waving is the electric and magnetic field. So I hope you find that just a little bit weird. Do you recall, I mean, where did the electric field come from? Do you remember that? When did you start using it? I mean, you get sort of used to it. You begin to get this vision of it. But what is it? Well, that's Maxwell's equation. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Yeah?
I'll only start using point charges.
Yeah, so, but quite honestly, you have Coulomb's law. Coulomb's law is something you can sort of get your head around, right? I have a particle here, I have a particle here, this one exerts a force on that one. How about that? Right? And, you know, you can feel it, measure it, it's there. The electric field, is, on the other hand, is sort of pulled out of thin air. It says, why don't we imagine that this charge here creates a condition in space over here, which we will just call the electric field, such that if I put another charge here, it will feel a force that is proportional to this electric field and in the same direction. Right? It is completely pulled out of thin air. And it is a very convenient calculational tool that I believe seems quite mysterious to most students initially, but you sort of develop mental pictures of it. Yeah.
Is it really pulled out of thin air? I mean, I feel like I remember the explanation for it being that forces can't really propagate faster than speed if you don't have the field to see.
You might motivate it that way a little bit, because when all of these equations were set up, no one knew that things couldn't travel faster than the speed of light, because Einstein hadn't done his thing yet. So I think it was true. Now, it turns out, though, I mean, you may have appreciated by now that there's this massive calculational convenience to it, right? The minute you talk about Coulomb, I have to know about the source distribution and the distribution that's feeling the force. The minute you divorce this condition in space from whatever creates it, you sort of don't have to worry about the source distribution again. And you can start talking about having a place in space that has an electric field of a certain form. And that makes sense. And you can say, okay, well, I know I can figure out some charge distribution to create it. And it sort of allows you to move on. So that's one thing. But there's no reality to it, at least the way that we usually think of it. But let's look at this a little bit. Yes?
Why is it negative in the magnetic field?
Why is there a negative in the magnetic equation? I think the essence of that is probably coming from Lenz's law. When you do induction, the field that's created, what is induced, fights the thing that induced it. So that basically gives you a negative sign in there. It's a restoring mechanism. So mathematically, that comes from this minus sign, which comes from that minus sign, and that's induction. And the fact that minus sign is there is basically saying whatever the rate of change is here, what happens here basically fights it. That's the essence of it. But I want you to notice that so what we've derived is clearly weight equations for E, weight equations for B, whatever in the world that happens. But each of those, we derive them, they stand separately as waves. But that doesn't really give you any insight into the connection. What we have here are a couple differential equations. This, remember, this is a curl. This is a bunch of derivatives in space, linear derivatives, so single power derivatives of B components in space. So you can think of this as the derivative of B in space goes as the change in E in time. Here you have the derivative of E in space gives you a change in B in time. These are completely coupled. If I take charge and I wiggle it like this, okay, I am changing the electric field in space around it. If I have a changing electric field, that creates a changing magnetic field in time. Ooh, if I have a changing magnetic field, that creates a changing electric field. If I have a changing electric field in space or in time, I have it in space, which gives it to me in time. And these things just feed on each other. Changing E generates a changing B. A changing B generates a changing E. These things basically are self-coupled, and they continue to induce each other, and this phenomenon propagates outward at the speed of light. And that is the essence of life. It is a wave in E and B where the coupling is, for E is the changing B, and for B it's the changing E, and they just self-couple. And that's why these waves can move through a vacuum. And as strange as it may seem, it has always seemed bizarre to me. We literally sort of use these fields as a calculational convenience to help divorce us from the things that create them, in a sense. But if you look at this, light is very real. And we understand it as a wave in E and B. And it's awfully hard for me to think my way through that and not think of these fields as very, very real. Is that cool? What? It really is.
Right. So where do we go from here? Well, what I'd like to do, all right, so get back. So insofar as we know,
this here is true. Okay, insofar as one has scientific truth, of course. If it's science, you know, you don't talk about scientific truth. But Maxwell's equations work. And these encapsulate everything we know about fundamental classical electromagnetism. That said, in this form, they're not particularly useful. And I don't believe they give you a good intuition as to the essence of light and ways to calculate things with it. So what I want to do in order to develop that intuition, what I'd like to do is to set up a very particular case. And I would like to then look at what we can learn from these equations in that particular case. So if you're not into it yet, you'll always start talking about boundary conditions. We're going to set up boundary conditions for a very particular problem, and we're going to study these equations in light of that. And so, but the thing to keep in mind is so we're going to set it up such that we will get an intuition about something called electromagnetic plane waves, and why it is called that or the obvious reason, etc. The caution here is that if you set up different boundary conditions, the waves may look different. Okay? So we're about to look at the case where I have a source of electromagnetic waves a point source that's very, very far away. Okay, so that as the waves go out, they go out in spherical symmetry because that's how energy goes, and we already know waves do that. And we go so far away that the curvature is irrelevant. Okay, so it looks like a plane coming at us. And those are called electromagnetic plane waves. If you take a metal pipe and you put the source in that pipe and you have waves moving down that pipe, they're not going to look like this at all. So just bear that in mind, especially since some of you may actually have to deal with the real world. Okay? That said, I do believe the starting place for your intuition about electromagnetic waves is the best place is really plane waves. So that's why we're starting there. We're not going to do fancy solutions to waves in other with other boundary conditions, but okay. Consider yourself warned. All right. So there you are, dressed in your red outfit, not eating very well these days, I guess. We have a point source of light very far away, such that we are looking at the surface of the ball of the waves coming off. The ball is now so big, that surface looks like a plane to us. Okay? And we're going to say that the source that we are along the x-axis, so that this plane wave is moving at us along the x-axis. So if we were to look at the electric field at some point along the x-axis way over here, it would be, or if we look at it as we walk up and down the x-axis, we would see that the electric field is changing both in position and time. Okay, so that's our wave. It is only a function of x. It is a plane wave coming at us. So if I have an electric field at this point, if x is that way and I have an electric field at this point, I have the same electric field at all points in the universe in that plane going that way, okay? That's the picture you want to have. Alright, so now I'm going to impose the boundary conditions, and that basically is a boundary condition. I'm just simply saying that this wave is moving in the x direction. I have no charge. So that means that if I look at the divergence of E, that L dot E is equal to zero. What is the divergence? It is it's this. Without pink lines, right? It's the derivative of E and X with respect to X, E and Y with respect to Y, and Z and Z with respect to Z, all added together. Note that E is only a function of X. It does not change in Y or Z. So these derivatives have to be zero. They fall away because of the boundary conditions. Right. The change in e to the x with respect to x is zero tells me that e to the x is constant for all x. E to the x is constant. Right? E to the x is the longitudinal component of the electric field. The plane wave is going this way. Maxwell's equations allow it to have a component that's longitudinal. And what I'm saying is, given these boundary conditions, whatever that is, it has to be constant because I have no row. It basically follows from this divergence to zero, so there's no row. I'm going to choose to let that be zero, just so it doesn't complicate me. Okay?
We haven't learned anything about EY or EZ at this point. Okay? So now I take
in the limit of no currents and no charges, I look at this Maxwell equation, and because this is a vector equation, I can take the x piece, the y piece, and the z piece. So if you go and you do the curl, remember you get those three terms. One is in the I direction, one in the j, and one in the z. And I take and I set each one successively equal to the I, j, and k components of the right-hand side. And that gives me these three equations. And now I look at the various terms in these equations. The electric field is a function of x and t only. So there is no, the derivative with respect to y or z has to be zero. So these terms both go to zero. If these are equal to zero, I'm seeing that the change in v and the x with respect to time is zero. So v and the x is constant in time. Similarly, I can make these two terms disappear. E is only a function of x, so there's no change in z, there's no change in y, so these two terms disappear. This term disappears by choice. If I have an electric field, what I know is it changes as a function of x and t, but if I have a plane in x, the electric field has to have a direction. And I just choose it to be in the y direction. Boundary condition, arbitrary choice. But once I've chosen it, I stick with that. So I have a plane wave. I have E. If I sit at a certain point, E is changing with respect to time. When it changes, it's everywhere in the universe in that plane. If I stand here and I let the thing pass through me, the electric field can change in its orientation, or it can change with respect to time. I'm saying that the vector E is just going to be in the y direction. It may change with respect to time, but it's always going to be in the y, along the y-axis, okay? Leaves me with this piece, because I've said that E is in the y direction, this is not necessarily zero, and I have that E in the y changes with respect to x as B in the z changes with respect to time. Try to get your head around that. Yes?
Doesn't this equation tell us that in fact E is a function of distance and time?
E is a function of distance along x. It can vary as you go out in x. And it varies in time.
Didn't we write the formula as only a function of distance?
That's okay.
The component of E in the x direction, we set to zero. But at this point, E could have components in the y and the z, and those components might change as a function of x.
I don't know where I got that. I wrote that.
No, that's quite all right. Well, I mean, if I were you, I'm sitting there thinking, I wish this was over, because I never call on anything in class. Seriously, I would just sit there and write everything down and then go figure it out later. In this case, I'm writing it down for you because if I don't, we have to pick three classes to get through this. And it's not, it is important. I want you to see it, but I don't want to waste the classes on it. So I'm sort of, I just throw it down here. So sorry if that.
Actually, you guys are doing pretty well. Most of you are actually awake. Cool. All right. So, what do we get out of this?
Note that this is E in the Y, and we have a time-dependent B field, which is in the Z. Okay? Now, I haven't said anything about B, really. I said that E is along the Y. And when you do that, Maxwell's equations tell you that if I have E in the Y, I'm going to have E in the Z.
And maybe this
shouldn't strike you as too much of a surprise. Remember when you're doing Faraday's law induction problems, I have a current loop, and I have a magnetic field going this way that's changing. What does it do? It induces a voltage or an electric field, an E dot dl, at right angles to it in this loop. Right? So you play with that a lot. It's actually sort of coded in here in Maxwell's equation. So go through this, play with this stuff, sort of get comfortable with it. But obviously I'm not going to have you do this kind of derivations or whatever in this class. And in other classes you may do this a bit more carefully. But what I now want you to do is I hope that I can tell you what comes out of this. And this is the stuff that I want you to sort of hold. So what we find is that E and D are perpendicular to one another. They are transverse. Remember we showed that the X component of E is constant and we call it zero. So there is not a longitudinal component, it's a transverse piece. E is oriented along the Y axis. B is oriented along the Z axis. Right? Yes. The E,
what Maxwell, with these boundary conditions, told us is that the E and the X is constant.
And that's because there's no charge.
So the divergence is zero. And we just set it equal to zero. For B,
we choose E along the Y, and the E and the Y component here is related to B and the Z component. This is zero, that is zero, so B and the X and B and the Y are zero. Or constantly choose them together. Okay?
So we've already seen that E and B separately satisfy wave equations.
So now I'm going to write down a solution for E, which satisfies a wave equation in E. We've said that E is oriented along the Y, so I'm just going to say E and the Y. It's a function of X and T, boundary conditions. It's along the Y, so I'm going to say that it's a harmonic function with an amplitude I'll call E0Y. It's a wave that can change spatially along X and time, so this would be a transverse wave that propagates in the X direction, in the positive X direction, because I put a minus sign in here. And it has a temporal frequency omega. So, we've already done plenty of this with the wave equation, so you know that this harmonic function will satisfy the wave equation. This exact form of it in terms of the X's and the form of it basically is specified by the boundary conditions that we chose, having the source very far away and the things propagating in the X direction. And then Maxwell tells us there's no transverse, there's no longitudinal component, or it's irrelevant, and we have a transverse component. We then choose it's in the Y, and when we do, what we learn is that B is going to be in the Z. So if we say that this is E, E is along the Y, harmonic in X, has a wavelength lambda, a temporal time period T, and we can give it an initial phase condition if we want.
I'm not finding the right equation for that. Remember that dBz with respect to t is equal to dE in the y with respect to x. So we just saw that right up here. dBz with respect to t is dy dx. So if I take this equation and integrate in time, then that's what I have written here. So this means we can solve for b and z by taking this expression for e and integrating with respect to x over time. So we get the integral, the derivative of e and the y with respect to x pulls out the k. So we have k times e0y times the sine of kx minus omega t. I'm going to set phi equals 0 for now. And then I take this integral of the sine, and there was a minus sign in here. Let's see. Derivative of cosine is sine minus sine, right? So that's why the minus sign disappeared here. So the integral of the sine is cosine, and now I'm taking the integral with respect to t, so I pull out the omega here. I have the 1 over the omega. So I have k over omega e0y times the cosine of kx minus omega t. If we specify this is e, this is what b is, according to Maxwell's equation, with the boundary conditions we've set up. Note several pretty important things. This phase that we chose of phi equals 0 ends up being exactly the same phase here. So e and b are in phase. E is along the y, b is along the z. So e and b are at right angles to one another. E and b are transverse. E and b are traveling in the same direction. And the magnitudes are related. If this is the magnitude of E, this is the magnitude of B. What is this? This is 2 pi over lambda. This is 2 pi over t. This is t over lambda. That's 1 over c. E over c is the magnitude of B. So it's sort of funny. Once you set what E is, what D is basically just follows from it, and it's very fixed. E and D are at right angles, they're transverse to one another, the magnitudes are related, they have the same phase. Okay? So, you do what I call the electromagnetic plane wave boogie. All right, to get a sense of this, I have some better apples for you, but think about this. This is y, this is x, all right? And I don't know if right-hand coordinate system. Okay, so this is z. What it says is that e and b are in phase, at right angles to one another, transverse. The wave is going this way. If I have eyes that are sensitive to the vectors, and I could see them, what I want to do is with my arms, I'm going to represent the E and the B vectors in this infinite plane, okay? As the wave comes, I'm going to say that I start with E equals 0, B equals 0, okay? As the wave starts passing through me, E and B, they're harmonic, so they begin to grow in phase, like this, right? Until they get to maximum amplitude, then they do this, okay? So that's what they're doing. If you stand there and you can see them, they just go, okay, this is what's happening. So each E and B are each, in a sense, if you think of the tips of the vectors, right, they're executing simple harmonic motion. In phase, okay? It's very cool. Now, if you're not into dancing, as obviously I am, boy, let me see if I can get this to work for you. Nope, problem. Take the long way around because I don't remember the URL. Sorry, this is going to strike you as absolutely ridiculous, but I should have remembered my URL. See if this works. Fine. Gets me to here. Good. Now I know where the links are, so I want to go here. Oh, okay. I guess that might work. But I'd rather fritter away most of my life doing this every day 5 times. I also haven't put this link on that page, so I have to do it this way. Oh, but that's not the class I want, actually, because I haven't put the link on your page yet. So, sorry. Let's try this. Let's try 142 way back when. I go here. Yes. Come on. I designed it.
Seriously?
Yeah, I had some. There was a company here called Truth and Beauty Software, and they implemented it. But okay, so here you go. It's a little deceptive in the sense that it gives you the sense that, all right, so here's the X. The electromagnetic plane wave is coming through this way, and these envelopes represent the magnitude of the electric field in that plane at that moment. And what is a little deceptive is it makes you feel like you're sort of seeing this finite thing that's like a beam. You're not. Remember, these vectors represent the electric magnetic fields everywhere in that plane as this thing passes through. Okay, so we have E is oscillating in the Y, and B is oscillating in the Z. This is the amplitude, same amplitude, but divided by C. Obviously, you can't see that in its own way. If you want to change the wavelength or the frequency, you can do that. So this would be a higher frequency wave and a low frequency wave. You can look at it in different places. You can pause it, step through. I'll give you the link. We can do that if we want. Is that cool? So that should be your intuition for electromagnetic waves. And these two things are self-coupled. E and B, a changing D creates a changing E at right angles to it. A changing E creates a changing B at right angles to it. And this whole thing propagates at the speed of light. Yes?
So if these waves are self-coupled, why would they ever stop? That's when I have a light source, and if it's light, stop the main light. Why does the light propagate forward instead of just being a beam sitting there instead?
I'm not sure I followed that, but if I have a source of light and I have it on, the light goes out.
Yeah.
When I turn this off, that light would still be going if it didn't hit the wall and
right, but
hit the atmosphere and all that.
You created this magnetic and electromagnetic, or yeah, electromagnetic wave. Just to take your light source. And it's also, does it what's understanding that the oscillation causes it to oscillate?
Well, whatever you have, whatever you're doing that changes the field to start with, the mental picture I like to use is I have a handful of electrons because I can sort of have this mental vision of a magnetic electric field, and I start wiggling it, and then I'll get, if I just wiggle it once, then you'll get, it, when you get into this in more detail, you find that any accelerating charge, excuse me, will produce electromagnetic radiation. The simplest picture is this oscillating thing. That's the intuition I want you to have. But it's, you can have blasts of electromagnetic radiation. I don't know. We'll look at that. Okay, I'm out of time.